Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. We are off today from the NBA Finals, again with Game 3 looming, and we got a little bit of news to catch up on, and then we're going to go through two wannabe Eastern Conference powers, Chicago and Atlanta, talk about their cap situations, their offseason. Chicago, interestingly, could have up to max space. They're not really being talked about at all as a free agent destination, and Atlanta has some really tricky situations with Al Horford and Kent Bazemore. But first, some news led by Steph Curry announcing that he will not participate in the Olympics after his injuring his foot, and then, of course, the MCL sprain that he has been recovering from during the playoffs.
It makes a lot of sense for Curry to prioritize the NBA season and everything that he's had to go through, especially considering he's missed so much time in the playoffs. And, you know, he's already proven himself on the world stage, though I believe he does not have a gold medal.
Yeah, he does. He has two gold medals from the World Championships, or what then became the World Cup in 2010 and 2014. But, you know, and it's kind of too bad. I was really hoping to see, much like actually in 2012, I wanted to see what it looked like with Derrick Rose, Adidas versus Nike, Derrick Rose wearing number 6 in 2010 and LeBron having worn it in previous Olympics, who would get to wear number 6. But then, of course, Rose tore his ACL this year. It would have been Steph and LeBron, assuming LeBron plays. Steph being kind of the new face of the league, but LeBron being more of a ball-dominant guy, almost kind of a guy with still seemingly more stature among the other players in the league. Nike versus Under Armour, and the fact that Nike is, of course, the big sponsor of USA Basketball. All those dynamics actually would have been really interesting to see how those guys coexisted on the same team, but now, unfortunately, we're not going to get a chance to see that.
Yeah, it's disappointing, as you and I are both international basketball fans, just to lose that, even though it does theoretically balance it a little bit better. The U.S. will still be more than good enough to win the gold.
So Steph is out. Chris Paul had already announced that he was going to be out, and then also with the fractured hand. Mike Conley is in the player pool, with him recovering from the Achilles, being a free agent. He's not really involved at all. So at point guard now, here's who your options still are for the U.S. Kyrie Irving, Damian Lillard, John Wall, Russell Westbrook. Those are the four guys who would be part of the pool. I would imagine that they probably would take three of those guys, assuming that they all still want to play. And if I had to guess on who would be the guy left out, it would probably be John Wall. And actually, no, never mind. It's not going to be John Wall, because he also is recovering from knee surgery. So it's basically Russ, Lillard, and Kyrie are the only point guards left from the initial player pool. I would actually expect probably all three of those guys to end up playing, especially because they've played Russ at the two a lot previously.
Yeah, I would expect all three of those. And they can bounce around defensively on assignments, especially against international teams.
LeBron has not announced whether he's playing yet. They are kind of waiting on his decision. Jerry Colangelo said they basically are down to 15 guys, did not reveal who those were still, although you can start to kind of surmise it when you consider some of the other people who are out. Like Blake Griffin is going to be out after recovering from that quad tendon injury. Anthony Davis is going to be out almost certainly. And I guess that's it. Probably pretty. And LaMarcus Aldridge also has announced that he's out. So you've now really got, I think, who do you look at as being the locks at this point, in addition to maybe those three point guards, at least two of whom are locks for sure?
Yeah, it's interesting because the first guy I thought of were the big men like Cousins and Drummond, but they each have kind of, they don't have that trademark history with Team USA to necessarily lock it in. Draymond, I think, should be a lock if he wants to play. Klay Thompson,
yeah,
too.
He said he wants to play, and so is Klay. So, yeah, you would have to imagine both those guys will be on there if they want to play.
Yeah, and I think Jimmy Butler said that he would play if he got asked. He should be on that list to me.
Well, let's see.
Paul George.
I mean, I would put him in the hierarchy below Kawhi, below Paul George, below LeBron. Iguodala, I mean, they kind of need like an old head maybe, but I don't know if he's going to play at his age. And then you kind of get into James Harden. If he wants to play, I'm sure he'll be on there, being a USA Basketball vet. Kevin Durant, obviously, if he wants to play, he's going to be on there. And then you're really just asking who the centers are. I think that's probably enough wings and guards, all those guys we just named. I'm not sure exactly how many that is, but I think DeAndre Jordan actually might be, especially with no Haka in international play, it's down to him, Dwight Howard as a center, Cousins, who you mentioned, Andre Drummond, maybe even, you know, Kenneth Faried, just as an energy guy who probably won't play very much. You know, he could even be an option. He played really well in 2014. He's really the best basketball he ever played in his career. So yeah, this team's still going to look pretty good, but the Steph opting out is kind of removes some of the drama, unfortunately.
Yeah, it certainly does. And yeah, you know, it'll be fun either way, but it does take out some of those truly epic lineup combinations, just like Anthony Davis being out took out some of them as well.
Dave McMenamin is reporting that a source close to Kevin Love told him that he is optimistic about his chances of playing in Game 3. The Cavs say they don't know for sure until tomorrow. It's going to be interesting to see what happens there, because there is a very specific protocol of steps that need to be taken. It's not the sort of thing where, hey, I don't feel well, oh, now I feel great the day of the game, I can just go out and play. You need to actually go through the steps of the concussion protocol, various testing, advancing to basketball activity, checking for symptoms after that. So while he may be optimistic about playing, I'm not quite sure that the protocol would allow that. But the other issue, of course, with this is that you're relying upon the player's subjective statements of whether they're able to play or not. And kudos to Love for taking himself out of the game when he did not feel like he was feeling right in that third quarter. But, you know, there's always the chance that he could just kind of try to manipulate the testing a little bit. And that's any time when you're dealing with subjective reports from athletes to make your diagnosis, it makes things more difficult.
It does. And the Cavaliers should definitely, even if he does play, they should definitely have a short leash. Unfortunately, with Channing Frye, they have somebody who can do many of the similar things, albeit to a lower degree. And Channing Frye really hasn't played much in this series, so they can scale him up if they have to.
Yeah, and I think even I might consider just starting Frye at center and starting LeBron at the four to try to get some more offense, see if you can at least get Kerr to stick with his conventional lineups to start, but see if you can tire Draymond Green out at center a little bit. But I don't know. There's not really a great answer there. This is an interesting one. Terrence Ferguson, who is a class of 2017 wing, a guy who has been in the USA basketball pipeline, excellent standstill shooter, not a ton of off-the-bounce game at this point, but really athletic. Think of him as sort of like a better shooting Gerald Green, maybe not quite that type of bounce, but still pretty darn good. He was going to play at Arizona. Now he is not going to play there. He's going to play overseas. Reports have indicated that might actually be in Australia. I certainly advocate any player who wants to go overseas, work on his game, and actually get paid for the privilege, although the Australian League doesn't, you don't make a ton of money there, but I think the culture shock is a lot less there. Everyone's speaking English. It's kind of more of a similar basketball culture to the U.S. Jordan McRae actually was someone who went over there after being drafted and now is in the NBA playing for the Cavs. You know, I don't know if he's ever going to be anything, but that's another person who has done that. So I applaud Terrence for this. I think that the NCAA, the fact that you can't make money doing that is not that great. I don't think a lot of the coaches are that great in terms of actually developing better basketball players, although some certainly are. So be interesting to see what happens with Ferguson, whether it is in fact Australia or it's somewhere else overseas instead. But kudos to him for trying that. He actually went to the high school that is the successor of the one that Emmanuel Mudiay went to last year. And so it may be that this is even forced by potential eligibility concerns. But nonetheless, good for him, regardless of what his reasoning is.
And anytime a high-end recruit decides not to go to Arizona, it's good for me.
Jeremy Lin and Bismack Biyombo are both going to opt out of their contracts that were paying them under $3 million for next year. Not a surprise. Those guys are probably both going to make eight figures a year or close to it.
Yeah, and we talked about Charlotte's options with Lin being a non-Bird free agent and just that they basically have to use cap space to sign him when we did their offseason preview a little bit ago.
The other thing, the NBA referees issued a statement today saying that they want to end the last two-minute reports. I am not in agreement with that, although I do think they raised some reasonable concerns. Here are the reasons why they think that they should end these, and I'll paraphrase here for the ones that seem more salient. Transparency doesn't change the outcome of the game, duh. Encourages anger and hostility toward NBA officials, and encourages stat-oriented instead of game-oriented officiating. And then a couple of other things, like they're encouraging the idea that perfection in officiating is possible when it isn't. That seems like kind of BS. And transparency has been misused by some teams to mobilize fans against the officials in an attempt to coerce more favorable treatment. That seems ridiculous. And there's no evidence that there is progress towards the goals of understanding and credibility, which is what the point of transparency was. And then they also have some concerns about the process and some reforms, which I think are a little bit more legitimate. What do you think of those arguments that I just named?
I understand where they're coming from, first and foremost. It is something that has the kind of the effect of making referees look bad in that sense. But a lot of the arguments that they use seem a little bit flimsy to me. That, yeah, it is true that it mobilizes that against refs, but people were doing that even when it was just video. Like, there isn't that much that's different. You just have the, whether it was the incorrect call or the correct...
Yeah, what does that even mean? Are they, like, are teams, like, putting up the last 2 minute reports on the scoreboard? Like, I really don't understand exactly
yeah, there
like
aren't
what
press releases
the team
coming
is supposedly
out with
doing.
It. And I think that there one aspect of it that I really do think that they should improve is the idea that every call is kind of correct or incorrect. There are some real gray areas in the NBA, and they could say, you know, it should have been called this way, and maybe even some of the explanations for why refereeing is so hard. I mean, I understand that refereeing will never be perfect, and I actually agree with that sentiment, though I'm not sure that's an argument against the last 2 minute report. But I think that the league in general should emphasize that part of it, that, you know, these are judgment calls and these are professionals and they should go in that direction. And I was encouraged by Commissioner Silver saying in his pre-game one press conference that they're at least considering going to a fourth official, which is something I fully support.
Yeah, they will every once in a while note on those reports that, yeah, you can only see it from in slow motion or from some special camera angle or something. I would like an understanding of like, hey, this was a pretty close call, you know, as opposed to just correct or incorrect. Some of those are just so close judgment type of calls. But that said, I love those reports because I find them very educational. And I then try to educate others using my platform on that as well as to what the rules are, what the interpretations are. I don't necessarily agree with the conclusion that they reach in all of those reports sometimes, but it's very educational for me to see where the league is coming from, what they say is a foul, because now I can apply that just to my overall viewing of the game to know what should be a foul and what shouldn't based on those examples. So I find that useful there. I would love to see the reports extended to all 48 minutes, basically, and to see, because you can't, you know, just like teams talk about, hey, I don't want to be in this position where at the end of the game, one bad call can make us lose. I also would like to see, you know, all right, did the bad calls favor the home team, you know, 10-5 over the course of the game or something like that? Or just in general, do bad calls favor the home team? Like, having access to that data over the course of an entire game, that's when I think you could really start to draw some conclusions about, like, okay, are the refs doing well? Where are they screwing up in more often? What are some calls that you'd like to see done differently? Did the refereeing really affect this team over the course of the entire game, as opposed to just the last 2 minutes? That I actually would advocate for more transparency, not less.
Yeah, the other one, and I don't know if this is possible, it might even actually partially be done now, but using the SportView stuff for referee positions to figure out whether this would almost definitely be privately held, the position of referees versus who is making the call. Like, I would be very interested in that in a sense, and also giving that to smart people who know what to do with it would be great in terms of transparency, even if it's opaque transparency in that sense of just another information dump. Because just learning how the game is officiated and all that kind of stuff, not only will it make people like us understand it better, and hopefully we can diffuse that to everybody else, but I think that will help teams and referees themselves too to be a little bit more aware of any potential issues that could be coming across that you just can't see looking at it case by case in just 2 minutes.
Yeah, and I think honestly, I'm someone who's defended the refs overall. I think that a lot of the issues that I have with refereeing come from the league office just not telling them the right things to do, frankly. But I mean, I'm going to be honest, I think they're just wussing out on this. Like, just deal with the criticism, try to get better, be okay with it. So I think that, and one other thing too about the last 2 minute reports that might be a little more sinister, I don't even know if this has occurred to the league, but after a big game, they actually like allow the news cycle to continue about a game, keep people talking about the NBA even more when that report comes out at 4 p.m. or whatever it is the day after a big game. Now there's more time to kind of talk about it. If you fall into the idea that any publicity is good publicity, maybe it actually helps the league in that respect. So they do have a couple of, this is probably too long on this, but they do have a couple of recommended process reforms. They want an appeal process. They claim that they don't know who in the referee operations office is evaluating the game footage. And they also say that they claim that the rules are not being interpreted consistently with what the point of emphasis is, but I can't say whether that's true or not, frankly. I have seen a couple of calls that I've been surprised at were deemed correct or incorrect based on what normally gets called, but I don't really know enough about any of that stuff to comment on whether that should be done or shouldn't, or what where they're at this point. One thing I do know a lot about, though, is Indochino. Indochino has been a great boon for me because I'm somewhat of an oddly shaped guy. I've got big shoulders, small chest. I'm 6'6". Finding suits off the rack, really difficult for me. If I do find one that fits me, they say they're going to tailor it. The pants are always too big as well. But Indochino has solved all my problems for me because they make made-to-measure suits that are now totally affordable. You send in 14 unique measurements, or if you're in a city with an Indochino store, you can go right in. They'll measure you themselves. You get to customize whatever you want, your lining, lapels, monogram, the shape of the pockets. You know, if you like kind of sleeker suits, that's good. If you like kind of more old school, a little bit less slim fitting, they can make that for you as well. They also do made-to-measure dress shirts and accessories, and they have a money-back guarantee if it doesn't fit. You can send it back. They'll try and fix it for you. If it still doesn't work, you get your money back. So it's basically just a revolution in men's fashion. You can get something made-to-measure. It used to cost thousands of dollars. Now, though, my listeners can get any premium suit for just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com when entering that familiar CapSpace code. Easy to remember. We talk about CapSpace all the time in the program, just like we are about to with the Bulls and Hawks. And shipping is free. So no reason not to try this. Indochino.com, promo code CapSpace. You can get any premium suit for just $3.99 with free shipping. Your look, your way. So you would think in most years, a team that was in the number three media market in the league had a great history, one of the league's marquee franchises, having max cap space, or basically close to it, would be rumored to be in the mix for all the best free agents. Yet no one at all is talking about the Chicago Bulls this year. I wonder why that is.
I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, especially...
And maybe because no one wants to go there.
Yeah, it could be just an issue where a lot of the best guys aren't really going to move, and so there isn't really that interest. But considering that Chicago's biggest glaring need is a center, and this class is pretty deep in centers, it is a very real chance that they get one of them.
Yeah, I think so. So that's... We'll talk about where they're at right now. They've got really plenty of guys on this team. This is a deep team. I mean, they need to improve at backup point guard, probably. And that was something that I think sunk them last year. And obviously, they were injured. You know, they just need to get better with health. Jimmy Butler missing a bunch of time and then not quite being the same guy. Etuan Moore with his hamstring. Noah going out completely torpedoed their defense. But they've got Mirotić at the four and Taj Gibson. That's a totally good rotation there. I think that between McDermott, who I expect to get better this year and I think is being underutilized even, Jimmy Butler obviously is, if not a superstar, an all-star quality player. Rose, once his face healed, was totally fine at point guard on offense. And like Moore is someone that they could bring back. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Mike Dunleavy maybe can become more of a rotation guy again after a summer to let his back heal. Tony Snell was out of the rotation, but at least shoots 40% on threes and isn't bad on defense. Justin Holiday, kind of same thing, decent shooter. He got some minutes. Cristiano Felicio actually had some great moments. I think I would actually be okay with him as your backup center going forward. It's just that the pieces didn't fit together and they couldn't stop anyone late because it was just Gasol at center and Mirotić, and Butler was a shell of himself on defense, and McDermott isn't any good on defense either. So you're right. They just desperately need a center who can defend. And if they do that, I think they're right back in the mix for, you know, even as high as like the 2 seed in the Eastern Conference and, you know, going down to maybe 5, 6, 7 at the worst.
Yeah. And their depth, as you mentioned, their depth 2 through 4 is pretty good. I mean, you also didn't mention Bobby Portis, who I think could end up being a rotation player for them. And they have enough depth at the four that they could easily move one of those guys if they decided that they didn't want one and get a contributor somewhere else. I mean, if you could trade Taj Gibson or Portis or whoever and get a backup point guard, you could probably do pretty well in this market because those guys would play 20 plus minutes, especially Taj. I mean, Taj could play 30 minutes for a solid team. So if they wanted to go that direction,
yeah, if he's healthy, of course.
The
question for all these guys. But,
and so, so the Bulls have some talent that they could move if they wanted to. They have a meaningful amount of cap space. They just have to do it right. And the other thing, and it's funny because we've had a couple of teams where this has been true recently, and Chicago, I think, is more prominent with this, is that they also have a possibility of serious, serious money in 2017. And so they like the Lakers, which we talked about yesterday, can think about this as a two-part thing, because they could have about $60 million if they keep the powder dry this year.
So Gasol and Noah are the two big ones. Noah, it was reported that by Joe Colley that he has already told teammates he wasn't coming back. There was then some pushback on that from his agent, Bill Duffy. His cap hold is $20 million, so they're really going to probably have to use cap space to re-sign him. Gasol, his cap hold is 9.6. He's early bird. We'll talk about him in a little bit. But I think Noah, if he just, you could guarantee me he'd be healthy, I think it'd be fine bringing him back. But if this is a team that's planning to be good, we saw what happened to the defense without him last year. They just have to have a defensive option at center that they can count on. And Noah, with his health issues at this point, age 31 as well, some of his issues also alluded to between he and Butler. Personally, that's something that actually that Vince Goodwill talked about on his podcast, which is actually a good one with Sam Mitchell. I recommend you guys listen to that over the weekend. So with their probably about $22.6 million in space, and they could actually, there's plenty of guys they could easily dump to get up to $26 million, which would be the max. But who would you like to see them go after on the center market?
Whiteside would be fascinating because they don't need as much offense, and his defense potential, we saw this in the series against the Raptors. Like, the difference when he was on the floor with Lowry and DeRozan and when he was off the floor was night and day.
Yeah, he doesn't strike me as a Bulls kind of guy. They would have basically right at his max. He's been relatively healthy until that MCL injury. I think he would be great for them. You could play pick and roll with Mirotić at the four, start Mirotić, play him at center. You run pick and roll, you've got spacing around him. That would actually, I think, could be very, very effective. But, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with him as far as staying in shape when he gets his money outside of the Heat culture. And you also have to imagine that the Heat, unless they get into the talks with Kevin Durant, are simply just going to bring him back. And they can offer about $4 million more over the course of a four-year maximum contract than the Bulls can, just by dint of the 7.5% annual raises instead of 4.5% because they're re-signing their own guy. You mentioned 2017. I think my ideal plan for these guys, and again, we've said this every time, so somebody's going to have to start offering longer contracts to actually get people, but I would love to just offer a really high contract for 1 year for someone that you know could defend, like Jan Mahimi. I would offer him just like 1 year, $20 million. And then try to bring back Etuan Moore, who has a really low cap hold, and just roll with that team next year. I think that they actually could be pretty good. I mean, they also could make a trade. They've got that pick from Sacramento that still might happen. It's top 10 protected next year. Otherwise, it turns into a second rounder. And I think Biombo, also a guy that they could look at, would be pretty good defensively. You would have to give him more years than just the 1 year. Is there anyone else that you think, and Mahimi even, 1 year, $20 million might not be enough for him, although at 29, the ability to go back onto the market afterwards might be useful. Is there anyone else that you like that could kind of fit into that plan of, all right, we're going to overpay this guy for 1 year, and then we'll use our $64 million in cap space. It was still with actually, and that includes Mirotić's cap hold, they still actually would have a pretty decent cadre of guys, even with that $64 million in 2017 space.
I think if your goal is to be relevant next year, that's pretty much the whole list. I mean, there are other worse stopgap guys, but I don't think they're good enough. You know, Mozgov has not proven it this year, and Miles Plumlee is interesting, but he's not good enough to really move the needle that much. He would certainly sap up like 20, 25 minutes for a game for a single year, and I think you could get him on a one-year deal if the contract were high enough. But if we're talking about what I think you're envisioning for the Bulls of them being really relevant next year, I think that's just about the full list.
Yeah, I'm sure they could make a max offer to Al Horford. That might be something they would consider, though, again, you're eating into your space pretty badly in 2017 and beyond, and he's 30 already. Also, his buddy Joe Kidnoe, he'd basically would be replacing him. That'd be a little weird. So I wouldn't anticipate that would happen. They haven't been talked about there. I think Dwight Howard actually would provide exactly what this team needs. Your question there is just what kind of years are you offering him, and do you want to kind of deal with what is perceived as his drama? But I think he would be great. They need a good defensive center next to Mirotić. Because I don't think Felicio is that guy. I feel fine with Felicio and Bobby Portis as my fourth and fifth big men. But yeah, you just need a starting center to play 25, 30 minutes a game who's good on defense and that isn't a huge injury risk, and you hope that you can count on him. Yeah, that's maybe another problem with Dwight, too.
Yeah, and off the top of my head, I can't really think of any good expiring contracts that would really fit that either. There are guys like, or at other positions that might be gap fillers, but center, it's just not really that group. And part of that is also why something that I've advocated for in other teams' things for the big man is that as great as the 2017 class is, at this moment, it doesn't look awesome in terms of rim protection. So if the right guy came along, and that is, of course, a mandatory need for this team, and it's exceedingly unlikely that Chicago will get it through the draft, I would be open to giving them more years, especially if you can get, let's say, Biombo, if his price is at 15 or something like that, I think it'll be higher. But that contract will look fine in a year or two. So if you can get him and you feel comfortable with where he's going to be, you can bite that bullet now because you were going to have to be spending that money later anyway.
Yeah, you know who's really going to get paid in 2017? The best, there are plenty of guys who are restricted, but, you know, they're restricted, right? Like Noel, Gobert, like those guys are pretty good rim protectors as restricted free agents. But Serge Ibaka is really the only guy you look at. Then Andrew Bogut would probably be the next guy as someone who can protect the rim. And that's really it among your top 30 unrestricted free agents. So, yeah, Serge Ibaka is going to make a lot of money. You have to imagine he's probably going to get maxed out in 2017 for teams really looking for rim protectors. So you make a good point there. Maybe then your thought is, hey, we don't necessarily want to keep the powder dry here. Let's grab someone for 2 or 3 years and just have them be our center for the next couple of years. You know, so maybe that would be Mahimi, maybe 2 years for him, 2-3 years, $15 million for him. I might even consider going, you know, 3 for 60 for Howard, you know, something like that. And the other place they would need to improve is that backup point guard. If they're going to use cap space, I mean, one option they might have would be to try to stay over the cap and just acquire whoever they get at center in a sign and trade. Then they could use their full MLE on a backup point guard and hopefully also still bring back more too. And I guess this is as good as time I need to kind of explain what his situation is with his early bird rights.
Sure. So with early bird rights, you don't have the full flexibility of everything else, but it's tied to the player's previous year's salary.
Yeah, you can offer either 175% of the previous salary. That doesn't help the Bulls at all because Moore was making the minimum last year. But your other option is that you can offer up to a 4-year contract with 7.5% annual raises, starting at the estimated average player salary, which I think is going to be around $6.2 million or so to start next year. That would enable the Bulls to offer up to a 4-year deal, $26.5 million. Do you think that would be enough? Moore is 27. Do you think that would be enough to keep him? Is that too much for him? Is that not enough? You know, I have rated him very highly. I think you don't necessarily see it the same way, but as a guy who can play a little backup point guard, play some two, shoot the ball well, good defensive player, I actually think that would be totally reasonable, and especially when he's giving you the added flexibility of just keeping his minimum cap hold on the books until you re-sign him to that deal. I actually would offer him that deal on the contingent that on him waiting to sign it until after all of our other free agent business is done.
It's a little rich for my taste, but not egregiously so. Like, I think there will be substantially worse deals signed by point guards in this market. So if you could get him on that, especially to me, if you can work the magic and use him as kind of the, let's say, the fourth guard in that sense. So he's kind of bouncing between the positions. He can be your backup point guard in a pinch, can move up. I think that would
be
great.
Maybe he could just play backup point guard, and then Jimmy Butler is enough of a creator with the ball in his hands that, you know, you're okay with more just as your backup point guard. You don't need to go with another point guard. I would like to have one, but and if I could get him for 3 years and $20 million instead of 4 years and 26, you know, you don't want to be paying him necessarily when he's 30. He's a guy who's probably, you know, may have had close to the best year of his career last year, and, you know, you probably don't want to be paying him and counting on him past like age 29 or so. But I might do that. But if it took another year to do it in this market, and considering the fact that his cap hold is so low and you're basically getting free money against the cap this year to retain him, I think I would offer him that if push came to shove.
The only concern for me, I understand where you're coming from, is the idea that is money that is taken away for the next year. And while I think he would be a possibility to trade, like, let's say, if I would be bad if that was what cost the ability to have two max slots. But I always think that at a reasonable price, price, you could move him if you had to.
Yeah, and that's right. I think that whoever they're going to sign, they probably would be able to move. So, yeah, I think that, like, Howard, Mahinmi, Biombo, those would be the guys that I was really looking at. And then especially if you could do a sign and trade, and they could not do that with Biombo because Toronto wouldn't be able to sign him to the initial contract. But Mahinmi, they'd have bird rights on. Houston would have bird rights on Howard, so they could sign him to that. Stay over the cap, and then you could use your mid-level exception on a free agent point guard. Who do you think they realistically could get? I mean, or they're going to be stuck with the room exception on a backup point guard. Who do you like for them on the backup point guard market that you think could be realistic?
It's going to be rough. I've said before that I think that's going to be like maybe in the Ray Felton, DJ Augustine range. Maybe Ramon Sessions, who would actually be kind of a nice fit with Jimmy Butler just because he can play a little bit more off ball.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm trying to rehab my value as one of these backup point guards, I'd love to go to Chicago because you know Derrick Rose is going to miss some time. Like, you're going to get to start probably.
And on a likely playoff team, too. I mean, they're going to be good. Yeah. So you're going to get exposure not only because it's a big market, but because they're going to be around. So you have the possibility of getting a bigger stage than you would in some other places.
Yeah, I could see them maybe being a Mario Chalmers fit. Someone who can just run a pick and roll and not turn it over. Ish Smith might be okay there. Ty Lawson reclamation project could also be a potential option there. I mean, as someone who might even get a chance to start for them at times and could look good with some of that offensive talent around him. Hey, they could even bring back Kirk Heinrich.
To be an assistant coach?
Hopefully not to play very much. But so there, as we've noted many times, like Jeremy Lin is going to be too expensive for them. Probably Grievous Vasquez would be too. Ramon Sessions maybe could be another guy they could look at if they were able to get up to kind of full MLE range, or just whatever center they sign is only, you know, 13, 14 million, and then they would have some cap space left over, or they might even have to use that on more potentially. But I think, I don't know that another team would offer him the 4 years that they would, so they might be in good shape there. We'll see, though.
So the other, another aspect of their offseason that's worth noting is that Cameron Bairstow and Cristiano Felicio have non-guaranteed years at their minimums. Felicio, beyond being a better value for his contract, also has a January 2017 guarantee date. So I would say it's a virtual lock that he's in unless he's involved in a trade. Like, they're not going to decline. They're not going to cut him. Bairstow, to me, is a tougher call.
It's an easy call for me. He has not shown a single thing that indicates that he's an NBA player. And guess what? Getting rid of him, because they're going to have enough guys in the books. Dumping him actually would give you his full amount of cap space. Normally, when you don't, if you get rid of a guy and you're trying to add guys via cap space, there's a roster charge for the minimum, and he's only making, I think, like $800,000 or something. So you only would save $300,000. But because the Bulls have so many guys that they are keeping around already, they probably would have already 12 roster slots filled, or at least filled with cap holds. And so then you actually get the full amount of his salary. So there's no reason not to just cut him and re-sign him. I don't think he's going to be like in demand or something at the minimum if they feel like he's some good locker room presence. But I'm sorry, he's not any good. Like, I haven't seen anything in summer league or anything over the course of his time trying to play, even when they've been desperate for big men, that makes me think that he's an NBA player. He has no upside. He's already pretty old too. Like, just use that roster spot on someone who actually could become something.
The Bulls also have two draft picks. They have the number 14 pick and the number 48 selection. And 14 is a nice spot from what I can tell in this draft. You're probably not going to get an immediate contributor, but if your hope is to get a rotation player in a year or three, that would be great.
All right, we talked about them in 2017 already. The only extension eligible player would be Tony Snell. I highly doubt he would get an extension. He'll have a $5.9 million cap hold. Maybe he can emerge a little bit this season. I think he's been a little bit too much of a whipping boy by the Bulls fan base. But that said, he was still out of the rotation by the end of the year. His on-off numbers actually were great last year. And I think if the Bulls aren't going to make any use of him, that he could still be a decent player. I mean, he shoots 40% on threes, can't really do anything else offensively, but can defend his position. I mean, I think as a backup, there's no reason he can't be a decent player. They cannot extend Mirotić because, as you'll recall, he waited until he didn't have to sign a rookie-scale deal, and he signed a 3-year, $17 million deal that'll be coming to an end next year. He still will be a restricted free agent, however, because he only will have 3 years of service, and his cap hold will be a little over $10 million or so, And that's, I'm counting that in that $64.4 million in space that they'll have. This is going to be a huge year for Mirotić. I think if he gets back to finally playing next to a real center who can defend, which he hasn't really had a chance to do much of in his career, that he could actually look pretty good and that he could have a breakout year. But then again, we thought that last year too, and he really struggled kind of until the end of the season.
Yeah, I'm optimistic about him, but he is going to have to prove it. It is not a definite at any point now. And tying in with Mirotić in that sense is this will be the last year of Taj Gibson's below market contract. So while he will be an unrestricted free agent after this year, that also does put a little heat on the Bulls to make a decision there, because as much as they're both good players, the prospect of letting one or both of them walk because they're going to be properly paid, that has to be the operating assumption, is that, you know, if you decide one of them is your guy, then you might as well get something for the other one.
Yeah, and Taj is a guy who I might try to move, because I think while I thought he was a very underrated player for a long time, and he's probably is about properly paid this year, that he's getting to the point where I don't think he is going to be a starting quality power forward anymore. His defense, his rim protection now, especially with all the injuries, the fact that he's now into his early 30s, because remember, he was 24 when he came into the league. He might be a little bit overrated, and it might be one of those ones where you want to sell a year too early on him. You know, if you could get a first-round pick for him somehow, I don't know that that would be realistic, but if you could get that, I would trade him for that, absolutely, at this point. I mean, they do kind of need him this year, but the hope would be that Portis can just play those backup 4 minutes. I don't know that he can. His defense was awful last year, and he shot a pretty poor percentage after a scorching hot start to the year. Takes a lot of bad mid-rangers, but maybe he can get better this year, and if they trust him to be their backup power forward, I would absolutely try to trade Taj if you could get a first-round pick. If not, you might as well just keep him around.
Yep, that seems like a fair calibration of value.
All right, let's get to the Atlanta Hawks now. The Hawks, another very interesting offseason for them. The two big variables for them, Al Horford, obviously. His cap hold is $18 million. He's 30 years old. We've talked before about what his negotiations could look like. Atlanta can offer him up to a five-year deal for $149 million with both their 7.5% annual raises as the incumbent team and also the ability to offer him a fifth year. You would have to imagine that since he's been a Hawk his whole career and that he would be hard-pressed to make $33 million in when he's 34 years old in what would be the fifth year of that contract if he signs elsewhere, that would get it done for him to stay. The problem is that is going to probably not be a very good contract for the Hawks. And so I think where there's going to be the negotiation, if he does want to stay, is giving him the fifth year, but maybe not quite the full raises, or maybe a little bit less than the max, something along those lines. But with his cap hold being $18 million, his max, which you'll certainly get at least in year one, will be $26 million. So they basically get about $8 million in free room from him.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense for Atlanta to go after him as hard as they can reasonably. But I do understand why they could be gun-shy about that fifth year, because Atlanta has so much uncertainty even a couple of years in the future that having that as basically your only light post is a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, so and if they lose him, then their cap space goes up by $18 million. With his cap hold right now, they would have about $15.8 million in space. That would go up to a little over 33 if they were to lose Horford. And then other things they might do to open up more space. Mike Scott is non-guaranteed for $3 million. That's actually a value contract, but they could certainly, I think, trade him very easily, maybe even for like a second rounder or something. And then Tiago Splitter is $8.6 million in the last year of his deal. In theory, still, if when healthy, he could help them, but he's getting into his early 30s now. If they were able to dump him in some fashion, that could get him to $27.2 million in space in addition to dumping Scott. That's with Horford still on the book, so they could actually offer a max. The problem, though, is that they are going to have to use cap space to re-sign Bazemore, because the most they could offer him with the early bird exception, since he's only been on the team for 2 years, is that same four-year deal for around $27 million that the Bulls could have offered Etuan Moore.
Hawks fans should be very familiar with this conundrum because they dealt with it last year with Damari Carroll and Paul Millsap, but Bazemore is a little bit different in the sense that I don't think he's as mandatory for them as, like, I mean, Damari Carroll ended up going and the Hawks did okay, but at the same point, he is a very valued contributor and he could be potentially hard to replace.
So this is my question to you, right? I mean, what do we think Bazemore is going to get? I think he's going to get, you know, between $12 million to $16 million a year. because he, I think, proved himself as a starting level two, can shoot the three okay, at least as of last year, and defends ones and twos while he's probably too skinny to defend the three, as we saw against LeBron James, obviously. And that's something that the Hawks have got to be aware of after having lost eight straight games in the playoffs to LeBron, in large part because they just couldn't deal with his abilities in the post. So would you rather pay that $15 million? You're basically using up all your cap space on Bazemore, essentially, to bring him back. Could they do better with that money? Not even necessarily in terms of a better player, but just someone who's a little bit better fit, who actually maybe could have a prayer of defending LeBron and could also shoot a three. What options might be out there for them in that respect?
Well, I mean, so obviously Lance Thomas is an inferior player, but he is at least bigger, which is good.
Yeah, and he would be cheaper, too, than Bazemore, and you could maybe try to pick up another backup big man as well if you're not going to trust Splitter's health, which I probably don't at this point, frankly.
Then, I mean, Wall Deng is always a possibility.
Well, I'm guessing he's out because while Danny Ferry isn't there anymore, remember
true. I hadn't thought about that.
Those comments that got Ferry fired, essentially. So, while I think Deng actually would be a very solid fit there, and normally would be from a character standpoint, hard to imagine that level of forgive and forget from him.
I'm guessing you like Maurice Harkless there, who I would as well.
Yeah, he would be restricted. I don't know, especially if they retain Horford. I mean, they're probably not going to want to start him at $15 million a year. So it's hard for me to say. And also, with the restricted market, you're not going to get a decision really on that until July 9th, because the earliest you can sign him is July 6th. So I don't think they want to tie up their space too much. I think he would be an awesome Hawks University project, and he's shown the ability to defend reasonably well 1 through 4. He's young. I think he can get better at that. He would be a great fit there, but I think for this team, the opportunity cost of going after a restricted free agent, unless they completely strike out on everyone beforehand, seems pretty low to me. I think Gerald Henderson, actually, while he's not a great shooter, and that doesn't help them a ton, he is really strong. I think he would be very good at defending LeBron at this point in his career. I thought he actually did an okay job even on Blake Griffin at times, although not enough times from my perspective. I would have put him on him more in that series against the Clippers for Portland. Henderson can't shoot threes, but he's gotten better at it. Again, they might say, hey, we've had some success teaching these late career guys to shoot. Marvin Williams could be another guy that might be a pretty decent fit there. And then also the fact that he could be your backup four, too, would be helpful. And then maybe they could trade Scott as well. He's pretty redundant with Scott, but you don't know, would 2 years, $15 million for Williams be enough? You wouldn't. This Hawks team isn't going to want to go beyond the 2 years for him. They're very fiscally conservative. Who else pops out of you? I mean, that's kind of it when you get to guys who could plausibly defend LeBron among wings on this free agent market.
Assuming we're not counting Lance Stephenson?
Yeah, you can assume that the Hawks will not be interested in Lance Stephenson for their culture. They, Kevin Arnovitz always jokes that, like, there are only, like, 30 Hawks and Spurs guys in the league, and I think we can safely say that Lance Stephenson is not among that 30.
Yeah, so,
although I actually think he would be another guy, other than that, who, with his strength, his ability to create a little bit off the dribble, and, again, another Hawks University project, although we don't know if Hawks University with Kenny Atkinson, the guy who a lot of people credit for their player development, now that he's the head coach in Brooklyn, maybe Hawks University will not be quite as effective as it used to be.
Yeah, it could be shuttering its doors at least a little bit. One of the other things that I would love to see Atlanta improve on, and of course Splitter being able to play would help this, is having a third big man, ideally who could bounce between the two positions, who can actually rebound the basketball.
Yeah, actually, I mean, even just a pure backup center I think would be fine for them, because Horford and Millsap can both play the four, I think, just fine. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned Cole Aldrich. That might be out of their price range, especially if they re-sign Bazemore or get another wing to replace him. I think Joakim Noah would probably be out of their price range too, although we don't know exactly what the market will be for him.
That'd be fun, though, considering the history.
I think they could be an excellent Mozgov reclamation destination. Just when you're only counting on him to be a backup, and then you just hope that one of he or Splitter are healthy enough to still contribute. But yeah, I mean, rim protection, defensive rebounding, like someone who can be good at that and then just not totally suck at offense. Nene might be another guy that they could look at potentially. And when you're using these guys in a backup role, it doesn't matter, hopefully, as much that they are potential injury risks. Zaza Pachulia coming back could be another thought as well.
Miles Plumlee.
Yeah, again, you have the problem with him being restricted, and I don't think that they'll be able to offer him enough to make the Bucks not match, but maybe the Bucks just don't believe in him at all.
It could be a Corey Joseph situation. That's my theory with him.
They
basically just realize they're like, meh, and then just let him go.
So another guy I think may not, although they've kind of copied the Warriors a lot lately with some of the guys and even their strength staff, Mo Spates could be a nice fit there as sort of like Pero Antic redux. Not a guy who's going to defend or not even the greatest defensive rebounder either, but, you know, if they just strike out on those type of guys, he could really work there. I've always thought that Mirza Teletovic might be a guy who would be a fit there with what they want to do with their shooting among their bigs. Darrell Arthur could be another kind of one of those guys who can switch, play their preferred style of getting out hard on the pick and roll. So there are definitely guys, I think, who could help them. But if I'm really like, hey, we're going to just run this back one more time with this same core, we think we could like be a little bit better next year and match up better with the Cavs, I want that rim-protecting center, and I want someone who can defend LeBron. And it's realistic maybe that they could get those guys, but probably not because then they would lose Bazemore. But if they bring back Bazemore, that would be totally fine too. I think they'd be a totally good team again next year, maybe take a little bit more of a step back offensively and win, you know, 45 to 48, 49 games, something like that.
Something else that we have to discuss, even though it might not necessarily be decided this summer, is the resolution potentially of their point guard situation.
Yeah, I think their problem is that neither of those guys are really good enough to really take them where they want to go as in like actual real contention for the Eastern Conference crown. Again, the Cavaliers bedeviled them with the exact same strategy that they always have going under. And in game one, Schroeder was able to hit a few shots, but over the course of the series, the Hawks were not able to make the Cavs pay nearly enough for that strategy. And Teague is getting older now. He's going to be 29 when his contract expires at the end of next year. Schroeder will be a restricted free agent as well, but I'm not sure that he is the guy that you are really feeling great about. Ideally, they could upgrade there, but they can't do that in this year's point guard market. And you don't necessarily, if you're trying to be good this year, I don't think you want to trade Teague. I think he's still better than Schroeder. So I don't know what you do there. Ideally, Schroeder would just always be your backup, but he's going to get more expensive as a restricted free agent. So maybe they try to get into the point guard market in 2017 when they're going to have oodles of space. But I don't know. I mean, if you gun to your head for next year, who do you think would be better? Do you agree with me that Teague is still better than Schroeder?
Yeah, I would say Teague is better for next year. I will note, while I don't think this is the nature of the discussions, if they could theoretically get Nerlens Noel for Jeff Teague, I think you pull the trigger on that in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. That would be
after all we talked about those centers, Nerlens Noel is miles better than any of them, except maybe Noel.
Yeah, that might be right. And just as a young guy, too, that they could re-sign, has a low cap hold. I mean, 2017 is crazy for them. Paul Millsap can opt out. He's going to be 32 at that point. When you just, and then Korver, his contract will have expired at that point. Tabo Sefolosha, Jeff Teague. I mean, they could just, whether because they want to or because just everyone leaves or they don't want to pay people enough to stay, this team could look so, so different. And I think they might just at that point be deciding to blow it up, but they could have up to $87 million in space in 2017. And that really only counts Schroeder and Hardaway's cap holds and a couple of smaller big guys like Walter Tavares. What about Schroeder's extension talks? What would you be willing to give him? His cap hold for next year is 6.7 million. Given where we've talked about where he's at, his limitations, but he's also younger, what would you offer him in extension talks, and would you think he would be willing to take that?
I think that given what we know right now, Atlanta is not a team that needs to hoard their cap space because they have so much of it that they actually, there is kind of a law of diminishing returns with that, because once you have enough space for two max guys, and especially when their whole roster is basically open and they, most of their guys cannot be extended. I would offer him something, and I don't think he would accept this, but I would offer him something in the 4 years, $48 million range, because that I think is a discount off of what he will get. I think he will get probably around $14 million per, because that's a solid backup or a low-end starter, and I could see it going way higher than that. So you get a little bit of a discount on that.
I mean, if he blows up this year, but like I feel like if he blows up this year, like that's a good problem, right? Like, and that cap hold is so much smaller to me. Like, I don't want to commit to him necessarily unless it's some amazing discount.
So like 440?
No, I thought that what you came up with was reasonable. I mean, you could look at him as like a low-end starter if he just kind of has normal development, and then you at least retain some upside as a team to where, you know, maybe his contract could be the equivalent of what Teague's has been for them the last couple of years. I mean, with the new cap, $12 million is basically the new $8 million. So that would actually not be too bad of a contract if he could become like what Teague has been. I don't know that he even could get to that level. But yeah, that might be something to consider. But yeah, anything above about $12 million a year, I'm probably out on extending him. What about Tim Hardaway? His cap hold, $5.7 million. Started to show. Oh, wait, was that the noise?
No,
again?
No, that was just an of uncertainty. I mean, I just don't. I can't think of a number with him. This is the similar struggle that I had with Deion Waiters. It's just the idea.
Yeah, maybe like the Jeremy Lamb type of contract. You know, maybe adjust it up slightly.
I wouldn't give him six right now. I mean, he could be worth that eventually, certainly, but I wouldn't commit to it at this moment.
Yeah, you know, there was talk like, hey, guess what, everyone? Like, all you guys who criticize this trade, like, he's look how good he's playing now, huh? And yeah, then he played like 4 minutes of playoffs. So,
and he also sucks at defense. I mean, if he,
yeah, I mean, you know,
then of course.
Yeah, and maybe they think even that they could let Bazemore go, try to get more of a combo wing, and then combo forward type, and then just trust him to play a bigger role next year. I don't know about that or not, but yeah, again, I mean, I think anything more than like, you know, 3 years, $21 million, I might do for him. Just, I mean, they obviously believe in him. They think that he's improved, and he had some nice games on the end of last year. I think just as like a sort of speculative play, it might be worth it. I mean, remember, again, like that's basically like paying someone $4 million a year under the old cap, you know, $4.5 million a year under the old cap. So it's not that bad. But yeah, anything more than that, I probably, again, you still have his restricted rights, and who knows, he could stagnate again next year. What about the idea of a trade for these guys to really augment? If they have that extra pick from Minnesota, the Adrian Payton trade, which is looking like a coup, although you also have to consider the fact that they drafted Adrian Payton to begin with, but then the fact that they're able to get rid of him and get that lottery protected pick from Minnesota, that's 2018. If they wanted to trade that pick, or, you know, the least favorable of theirs and the Minnesota pick in 2018, is there anyone out there that you think, either from that need of a backup big or looking at someone who could credibly defend LeBron, that might be available for that, you know, maybe someone who's in the last year of their deal that they could look to re-sign or something along those lines?
No one that I love. I do think that's a nice asset, and there will be eventually people who are available who could be a good fit, but there's no one that's screaming to me of being a great logical place for the Hawks, also given their just weird salary uncertainty.
Oh, you know, another free agent actually that would be pretty good for them would be Solomon Hill, now that I think about
it. Wait, he's an unrestricted free agent? How'd that happen? I'm still amazed that we made it through one of these, the Bulls one, without talking about Teletovich, because it seems like he's been one of those guys who's been in all of them, but he didn't make sense for the Bulls.
Yeah, it would be funny to go back and see, like, who is the guy that we mentioned as the possibility for, like, 25 teams. Their agent can thank us later, right? Yeah, Solomon Hill, actually, I think would be an awesome fit for them as well, and you could kind of play him and Millsap together and switch LeBron James, Kevin Love action, although that assumes that Kevin Love is still around for the Cavaliers next year, which may be, if they get swept, an unrealistic assumption. Yeah, nobody really pops out to me as someone that they could look at trading for.
I mean, Tony Allen seems like a little bit too much of a specialist, and I don't think he's big enough for LeBron, but just as somebody to kind of give them that defensive culture, I don't think...
Yeah, I mean, they basically already have Thabo Sefolosha to do that, right? Like, to be... I mean, he's not as good defensively as Tony Allen, but he's younger, and he's still a little bit too skinny for LeBron. Someone actually kind of down the list a little bit further they might look at would be, like, Wes Johnson, you know, obviously, again, a potential Hawks University reclamation project.
What about Wilson Chandler?
Kind of guy. Yeah, that might be a good one, actually.
I thought
again, I don't know. I don't know how good he is defensively, but he at least has a little bit of brawn to him.
PJ Tucker.
Yeah, PJ Tucker would be a good one. I don't know if I would want to give up a first rounder for him.
No, but just
that actually would be a pretty good one. I think, you know, maybe some second rounders, a second rounder or two for him, or you know, you trade like a Walter Tavares for him, someone that has like a little bit of, maybe that is probably not enough, but you know, someone on your roster who has a little bit of potential.
Would you trade Splitter for Tyson Chandler in that trade to take on his years?
Whew. It definitely makes you better next year, probably. I might consider that, yeah. I think that actually... So you're saying, like, Splitter for Tyson Chandler and PJ Tucker and throw in some other Flotsam for... you're basically, like, taking on Chandler's deal to pick up Tucker and then some other salary Flotsam as well that you could throw in. Yeah, that's not terrible. I might consider doing something like that.
I like making a fake trade and making you actually think it's reasonable, because I actually think that makes some sense. Like, as much as I don't think the Suns need to move Tyson Chandler, if they could do something like that, I think that would accomplish a lot of their goals at once.
All right, anything else we got to talk about for these guys? I think that about puts it in there. I mean, let me ask you this. What do you think the chances are that Bazemore is on the team next year?
I'd say it's about 50-50. There is a very real chance that somebody else falls in love with Bazemore. He has done a nice job now in a couple different locations, and he is a step down, presumably price-wise. And it's not like the Hawks can offer him anything definitive necessarily in terms of role that is meaningfully better than some other places.
Yeah, I would say 30% based on two things. One, just that the Hawks have confidence in their ability to kind of generate these sort of guys on their own, sign other guys on the cheap, replace them, and that confidence has been well-founded recently. And also just I think that paying him his market rate in terms of your matchups with Cleveland, balancing out the roster a little bit more, that you probably want to go with someone who is a little bit better fit defending LeBron than Bazemore is. So that would be the reason for that. All right, Al Horford, what percent chance that he is a Hawk in 2016-17?
75. I think they'll eventually work it out, but there are other teams that can make great offers to him.
If you are him and you wanted to go somewhere, is there another team that you think would offer him a four-year max and would be a better chance to win than Atlanta?
Boston, if they do it. You and I have discussed this numerous times on and offline, but I think Boston would be a better destination because they are...
Yeah, I think that's right, if they offer it.
Yeah.
If they offer it.
I would be fascinated by Chicago. I don't think it's necessarily a perfect fit, but it would be a really nice collection of players, and they have the upside that if they sign him on that contract, that they can bring in another really good player next year.
Yeah, I think that's right, too. What about the Dallas Mavericks?
Too much uncertainty. You know, I don't think Dallas is going to be better than the Hawks next year. And after that, basically their entire team is going to probably be free agents, except for Wes Matthews, who might not be a good contract at that point. We'll see.
Houston.
Interesting. I'm not sure that I'd be chomping at the bit to play with James Harden in that way. He's a wonderful player. I do like James, but Horford, it seems like he thrives with ball movement, and ball movement is not necessarily... Yeah. I mean, that could be part of
D'Antoni.
I mean,
now it's going to be D'Antoni. You know, hopefully it'll be better.
I like Boston's talent much more, and their draft assets much more than Houston right now.
The Indiana Pacers.
So he'd be playing... So their front court would be Paul George, Miles Turner, and Al Horford. God, I love that. I mean, but that's just me. You know, you're asking me to put Al Horford with two of my favorite, like, young forwards or young front court guys in the game. The problem there, and of course this is something Horford has dealt with basically his entire career, is that I would love to see him play with a legit point guard, you know, to have that. And as far as George Hill is a talented guy, I actually like him better off the ball than on the ball. But, well, you know, we'll see. I think that I also don't think that Indiana is going to be in the position to offer Al Horford that, considering all their other stuff.
Oh, they should. I mean, they have like $25 million in space or something, and then 32 if Mahimi doesn't come back. So they could offer it to him. But it just doesn't seem like the type of move that would be made. The Heat could be another one too, if either Whiteside leaves or they just decided they wanted Horford more than Whiteside. This you would love this, but it would never happen. The T Wolves.
I think he's a little too old for them.
Well, I agree, but you're probably right. Yeah, that's one of the big reasons. And just, you know, when's the last time they signed some massive free agent? The Blazers, would that be a better chance to win than the Hawks?
Yeah, I would say it would be. I think they should be looking for somebody a little bit more defensive and a little bit younger.
Al Horford is really good on defense. He's not like a great rim protector.
Yeah, you need a lot when you're going to play Damian Lillard and CJ. I think you need that traditional rim protector if you can get it, but their offense would be phenomenal.
Yeah, and Al moves his feet. I think he's an underrated rim protector, not a great defensive rebounder. But, yeah, so there are a lot of teams that what about the Wizards? Would they offer a better chance to win than the Hawks would over the next two or three years?
I think so, because they have guys locked in who are better. I mean, the Hawks have uncertainty, and I don't love uncertainty if you're comparing that to John Wall, Bradley Beal, and whatever they can get for Marcin Gortat, or even playing them together. That also gives Horford the opportunity to play a little bit of power forward, which it seems like he wants to do. Gets him away from the banging a little bit.
Yeah, so anyway, and we didn't even mention a bunch of the other teams, too, that aren't really that good that could offer him a max contract. There are a lot of teams out there, and I think while none of those situations are ones that I would say are clearly superior, at least next year, certainly in the long term, though, he's playing with more young talent. I think this Hawks team is just going to continue to age out and just get gradually worse. I don't see some great method to improvement for them. So, yeah, I mean, I think the Blazers, I would be very interested in the Blazers if I were him. Some of those teams we talked about in the aggregate over the next 2, 3, 4 years, probably a better situation for winning than the Hawks are with their young talent. All right, you got anything to plug before we go?
Yeah, I just released a Real Jam Radio episode with Adam Mares of Denver Stiffs, No Island Calculus, a bunch of things, on the Denver offseason, which I actually think is an underrated big one. Of course, you love Danilo Gallinari, and I've been fascinated by the possibility with him, but they also have a bunch of draft picks and some cap space. So we did that. Also, my Game 2 analysis of the Warriors-Cavs NBA Finals came out, and I'm working on the offseason previews, and the Knicks came out today.
All right, follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Don't forget about our sponsor, Indochino. You can get that made-to-measure suit using the cap space code at Indochino.com. And also, again, thank you to everyone who is giving us iTunes reviews and ratings. That really helps out the show as well, and we use that in getting sponsors. We'll be back tomorrow night after Game 3, do or die for the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. Till then.